Rabbi Asher Wade was born in Virginia, and Rabbi Wade studied at several liberal arts colleges and graduated with a Bachelor of Arts in Philosophy. Afterwards, he traveled to Scotland, where he earned a postgraduate degree in philosophical theology at the University of Edinburgh. There, afterwards, he moved to Berlin, where he spent 5 months at the Goethe Institute for Language Studies. While in Berlin, he also worked as an adolescent and marriage counselor at the U.S. Army Chaplaincy Center. After his stay in Berlin, he enrolled at the University of Hamburg, where he worked towards his first doctorate in the field of metaphysics and relativity theory. Nearing completion of his dissertation, Rabbi Wade was offered a teaching position at Cambridge University in England. Rabbi Wade is a convert to Judaism. His background is that of a religious Christian. While in Hamburg, he was ordained as a pastor in the Methodist Church. For 3.5 years during his doctoral studies, he was employed as a minister of an English-speaking Protestant congregation. Shortly afterwards, he met his German wife, whose father and grandfather were very pious Lutheran pastors. Several months after their marriage, he and his wife began to investigate Judaism. It took about a year's time for both of them to reach the conclusion that Torah Judaism fulfilled all the intellectual, academic, spiritual, and emotional truths for which they had been searching. After withdrawing themselves from the church and leaving the ministry, both husband and wife traveled to Frankfurt and converted to Orthodox Judaism. Rabbi Wade suffered the hardship of not being allowed to finish his first doctorate at the hands of his supervising professor, who it turned out had been a chaplain in one of Hitler's tank divisions, which rolled into Poland during World War II. He and his wife nevertheless stayed on in Hamburg as he pursued a second doctorate on Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch and the Orthodox Reform debate. 2 years later, with controversy still growing about his Jewish status, he withdrew from the university and together with his wife moved to the United States. Leaving the academic world and working in business for a number of years, Rabbi Wade was contacted by Neri Israel Yeshiv in Baltimore. This meeting led to he and his family being sent to Jerusalem, where he learned for a number of years at a very venerable institution known as Yeshivas Or Sameach. Several years ago, Rabbi Wade picked up on his prior interest in pastoral counseling and began working toward a professional doctoral degree in clinical psychology. He is presently living in Yerushalayim, in a place called Ma'alot Dafna, which is right near the shtibel where some of you guys daven when you don't wake up in time for davening. And his wife and 6 children, where he provides lectures, he conducts his very well-known tours of Yad Vashem, where people line up to try and get onto his tours of Yad Vashem, which is on a weekly basis, or those of you interested in joining any of the tours, you can contact Rabbi Wade directly, and you can speak to me, and I will connect you how to connect with Rabbi Wade. He does private counseling as well. So, gentlemen, it's with great pleasure to welcome on board the Saturday night live in Or Sameach, Rabbi Asher Wade.
I'd like to thank Rabbi Geffen for giving my lecture for me. If you have any questions, we can be done with it and go home now. He did introduce me by my name, Asher Wade. Often when Jewish audiences hear that introduction, they often puzzle and buzz amongst themselves by saying, Wade, did he say Wade, W-A-D-E? They say, is that a Jewish name? To which I can respond, no, but it is now. Obviously, as you heard from the introduction, it wasn't always this way. from so far afield as my wife and I to come into, of all things, Torah Judaism is for many people a wonderment. How could it possibly be from so far afield here, an academic coming out of the States, on to the University of Edinburgh for 3 years for a master's program, then after that, taking a private sabbatical of traveling to Berlin, doing studies at the Goethe Institute, but also taking a private internship at the United States Army Chaplaincy Center. After that half a year stay in Berlin, traveling on to the University of Hamburg, working in a very esoteric topic of theoretical astrophysics and ontology. Don't ask. But also, ever since the age of 16, had made my decision that I also wanted a dual-track career and wanted to pursue ordination in the Methodist Church. Ever since that age, I had been doing in-church requirements, tests, and studies, finished all of my oral exams, and a year after I was enrolled at the University of Hamburg, I was ordained as a Methodist minister by the visiting bishop out of Frankfurt. A year after that, I was called into a small church. I was a minister of a congregation for 3.5 years. Nearing the end of that 3.5 year time period in the church, I met my wife. I stated whose father and grandfather are very pious Lutheran pastors. My father-in-law actually married us in one of the 5 cathedrals of Hamburg. And I've just finished writing my rough draft of my doctoral dissertation, assuming that the rest of it would go pro forma, making the corrections, oral exams. So I went out on job interviews, and amongst other places that I received a postdoctoral teaching fellowship was at Churchill College at Cambridge University in England. I guess at that juncture in our lives and our development, I guess without being too facetious and without coining a phrase, you couldn't have gotten, well, more glatt Christian than my wife and I. So obviously people want to know, what could it take to turn around such a couple that had it already made in 2 areas of the world? Tenureship in the church, and now starting a teaching career off at Cambridge. I mean, let's face it, Cambridge is not exactly your local community college to start off with. It looks good on a resume. Not only that, but at that very early outset of our conversion process in Hamburg, many of my Jewish friends that we met made there often used to joke around with me by saying, Rav Asher, I don't understand why you want to convert. I mean, after all, you're already married. Catch on to that one, okay? But obviously, you know, with having that type of job security and already being married, it is sort of like a wonderment. How is it possible for such a couple to do such a thing as to drop everything, risk losing everything, and to come into, of all things, that which the Jerusalem Post writes about ultra-Orthodox medieval religious fanatical Judaism? So tonight, hopefully, I'm going to be able to hit some of the highlights of the past 25, 30 years of our life and development. Probably won't be able to do it proper justice, but at least give you an idea and a focus on what we saw and experienced that could turn everything around and to bring us into where we are today. But before we get into the highlights of my life story, I'd like to preface tonight's talk by telling you about the first time I was ever asked to deliver such a talk as this. Because you have to understand, I never in my wildest imagination imagined that by converting to Judaism that I'd be spending the vast majority of my life traveling literally around the world, telling over year after year to Jewish audiences a story that my wife and I considered was a dava pashut, an obvious thing. That is, when you stumble across the truth, you test it out, you verify it. When it rings true, you plug it in, implement it, and live it in your life, right? Right? Well, apparently, this seems to be a kiddush, a novelty to many people, because why would somebody do something like this, even if it's the truth? Why would you want to do something like this? Burden your life down, etc. So on the eve of this first talk, it's very interesting. Oh, and I should tell you one other thing. There was a personal mila, a personal advantage in me converting to Judaism, having been a pastor in a church for 3.5 years, simply because I'd actually grown tired of the job as being a pastor. Why? Simply because I didn't feel that I had the maturity, the wisdom, and the, you know, the theological wherewithal to command the respect that I was gaining from my congregation. As it was sitting there week after week in the church, hanging on every word I was saying as if I was bringing down some pearls of wisdom as an emissary from heaven. And so therefore, for me personally, converting to Judaism had that very private advantage because it allowed me, by converting to Judaism, an easy out how to get out from behind the pulpit. So after we converted and we moved to the United States, we joined an Orthodox shul, and I told the local rabbi there, I said, for me, you'll have no competition. I said, I just want to be a regular minion man, sit on the seventh row, third seat to the left, and sort of work on myself. As you can see, that didn't last very long. And there was a young Hebrew rabbi in the community that got to know my wife and I and our background and what we'd done. And he thought it'd be a novel idea if I were to work up a biographical talk and give it over to the community. He taught me one of my first Hebrew words. He said, it'd be great chizuk for the community. Not really knowing what that word meant, I said, fine, you want to grab that chizuk? Then if I still grab that chizuk, So he got a picture of me and an all biographical blurb, and he ran it in the local Jewish newspaper, which was distributed out to the community on Monday morning, advertising the upcoming Thursday night lecture. By Tuesday lunchtime, I received my first phone call in response to it. It was from a young couple. Husband was on the line. He says, Rav Asher, he said, first order of business, I get a mazel tov. I said, mazel tov, what's the occasion? See, the occasion is that my wife has just delivered our third child, but our first boy. But something very, very strange has happened, and we both now attribute it to that newspaper article about your upcoming lecture. And that is, he said, this morning when I went to pick up my wife and the baby from the hospital, as I walked down that corridor and entered into her hospital room, there she was sitting on the edge of the bed, baby in bassinet, hand luggage ready to go. As I crossed the threshold, we locked eyes and we greeted one another, saying the same statement simultaneously. We looked at one another and said, honey, let's have an Orthodox bris. He said, Rav Asher, you've got to understand, my wife and I have never done anything Orthodox in our entire lives, and this shook us up. When we came home today at lunchtime, this triggered off the first conversation about what Judaism means to us after 7 years of marriage. And he said, wouldn't you know it? After 7 years of marriage, we found out that we both had the same hidden agenda for our lives as Jews. And that was, all we ever wanted to do was to marry a Jewish spouse, primarily to make our Bubby and Zadie happy that their Anika was marrying a Yid. And then after that, and then he coined a phrase for me. After that, all we ever wanted to do was to float purposely, but nevertheless passively, through the revolving doors of assimilation, out into that American society, into that materialistic world. He said, you know something, Rav Asher? After 7 years of marriage, and after that conversation, we realized that this is where we were heading. But what did we see? As we were approaching the threshold of those revolving doors of assimilation on our way out, what do we see but a pastor and his pastor wife coming into those revolving doors of assimilation, into Torah Judaism. I said, Rav Asher, you've got to understand, this is a shock for us. Yeah, he said, you know, we were born Jewish. You know, we were born with gefilte fish and lox and bagels, you know, Hebrew school and Hanukkah bushes, bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs, probably more bars than mitzvahs. He said, well, we had the whole What did you two have growing up? Did we miss growing up? He said, if you'll tell us, maybe we'll give it another shot. Baruch Hashem, I'm happy to report to you that after meeting with them together and separately for private consultation, having them over for Shabbos, Yom Tov, after a couple of months, they decided that they were going to make a move. After all, he coined another phrase for me by saying, Rav Asher, let's face it, if you two can do it, we certainly should be able to. So they started after about 3 months putting up mezuzahs in their homes, and not just one on the front door, and kosher ones at that. 5 months later, they decided to kasher their kitchen. After that, they started keeping a shtickle Shabbos, lighting candles, making kiddush, etc. And about 10 months after that initial phone conversation, they decided to make the full swing, threw their television sets out of the house and put their kids in the proper Jewish schools. And Baruch Hashem, I'm happy to report to you, in less than a year, this family turned their whole lives around, and they didn't even get to hear the lecture. So what was it that could turn this academician on his way to Cambridge, ordained, tenureship in the church, with job security, already married, turn everything around and bring us into Torah Judaism? Well, I was a little bit nervous, I must say, even though I'd given many university lectures and certainly many sermons in church, but I'd never given an autobiographical talk. So on the eve of that first talk, I was a bit nervous. I wasn't really sure how to proceed. So I called up that young rabbi and told him, I said, I got a cold feet. How do I do this? He said, listen. He said, you're a professional speaker. Just start at the beginning and you'll wing it. You'll figure it out. I said, well, that makes logical sense. So I sat down and thought about, wait a minute, how did this whole thing get started? I had to sit down together with my wife and sort of backtrack, puzzle piecing things back together until finally, sure enough, though we'd forgotten about how it got started, we localized that there was an actual event Yes, one of those things that sort of jarred the gyroscope on the ship of life, that shook us up and basically redirected us eventually on the path that we were to take. And we localized it not only on the day, but nay, even the minute of the hour when this sort of like event took place. And no, it's not like those TV evangelists in America on Sunday morning that talk about, I've seen the light, you know. But it still has the same ramifications to this day. So my wife and I, it all took place at 8:15 in the morning on November the 5th, 1978. That was a Sunday that year. It was about 2 months after my wife and I were married. And we were going through the normative lifestyle movements of every young pastor and his pastoral wife on a Sunday morning. And that is, most pastors and their wives get up on Sunday morning, tune in the local FM classical music station for some mood music. You have breakfast. We perused over the local Sunday morning newspaper to pick up some interesting tidbits to spice up an otherwise normally boring sermon. And then we headed off to the local church to lead the 11 o'clock minion, church service. There we were, lounging at the breakfast table, remembering Christianity we eat before we dive in. Makes life a little simpler, you know. Going through the different sections of the local Sunday newspaper, section A, B, and C, I think it was. And I reached down to pull out the fourth section, section D, and as I did so, my eyes caught the pictures on the front page. I stood up slowly, spread it out across the kitchen table, and I said to my wife, I said, look at this. There before our eyes on that Sunday morning newspaper, we saw pictures of large synagogues engulfed in flames. We saw other pictures of yeshivas and seminaries firebombed. Outside the courtyard fenced in areas of these big synagogues, we saw piles of books, even Torah scrolls, kicked and dragged across the grassy lawn, piled up as if it was rubbish heaps. We quickly leaped into the interior section of the newspaper, saw the other pictures of the downtown shopping district with the storefront glass windows shattered and scattered out across the street and sidewalk, but only of Jewish shops. We saw other pictures of rows of Jewish men being marched in the centers of the streets with keepers on their heads by police officers. Picture after picture until we caught the headlines of the stories, the captions of these pictures, only to see that the entire segment of that Sunday morning newspaper had been dedicated over to the 40th anniversary of the German Kristallnacht. That night of broken glass, as the Germans so euphemistically referred to it, was now being revisited over some 40 years later on this November the 5th, 1978, looking back to that fateful November the 10th, 1938. However, there was something hauntingly familiar about these pictures, a sort of deja vu effect, as if we'd been there before. But we both realized that neither one of us were old enough to have lived during that time period. But there was something that sort of drew us into these pictures, as if we walked these streets. So we started backtracking, leafing from the back page back towards the front page again, looking and studying at these pictures, wondering what it was that gave us that funny, eerie chill down our spine, until we reached the front page again, looking at one another, still shaking our heads, what could it possibly be? And then we'd look back on that front page picture again. And then as our eyes drifted from the terror and the destruction portrayed in the centers of the pictures, our eyes drifted to the edges, and it was, yes, something now, as mundane as the edges of the pictures, for there, in all of the edges of these pictures, it gradually dawned on us that the editor-in-chief for that Sunday morning newspaper must have been quite clever so as to drive the point home to his local readership. He only picked pictures of Kristallnacht in Hamburg. Not the infamous pictures that you all know in school textbooks and encyclopedias of Kristallnacht in Frankfurt, Berlin, or Vienna, but rather this is a local newspaper with local pictures for the local populace. And it certainly drove the point home for my wife and I. As now, as we went through these pictures again for the third time, this time no longer focusing so much on the terror and the destruction, but this time studying all the edges, and there in the edges of all these pictures we saw buildings, neighborhoods, landmarks, intersections. Landmarks and buildings that we all knew. I'd lived in Hamburg at this juncture in my life for 3.5 years uninterrupted. My wife was born and brought up there. We knew it like the back of our hands. As we went through this, we saw one of the pictures that really just rattled us. It was the huge central synagogue down at the end of Bornstrasse, the central synagogue of Hamburg's Jewish community. I looked and studied at the edges of the pictures. The buildings are still there in the edges, and I localized it by reframing over some 40 years later. I said, on that corner plaza area where that huge cathedral-like synagogue is going up in flames, today is nothing more than a dirt parking lot. But a dirt parking lot that is attached to the Department of Library Science, a dirt parking lot that I would walk across from my institute to the main university library and back again twice a day, but in those days, never realizing where my feet were treading. Why? Because in those days, there was no plaque, there was no sign proclaiming to the whole world that on this parking lot area had once stood the huge central synagogue of Hamburg's Jewish community, a Jewish community that had numbered well over 40,000 strong before Adolf Hitler Maximo had come to power. Today, it was nothing more than a place for the students to just drop their cars and run off to classes. For my wife and I, this dirt parking lot, unmarked and unsigned, was a frightening example of revisionist history and practicum. Nobody had the habamina. Nobody had the presupposition to wonder what had transpired in history on this parking lot area. As I said, it was just a place, and many students were happy to have a place to drop their cars and run off to classes. But my wife and I, from that moment onwards, we designated that parking lot area as sacred territory, and we refused to walk across it with our feet, knowing what had transpired in history there. But this newspaper article triggered off a much more interested and more in-depth study of the Kristallnacht. Let me refresh your memory, because over the years I've noticed that not only your generation, but the older generation are letting slip some of the frightening historical parameters of Kristallnacht, which I think, unfortunately, condemns the whole world. Kristallnacht for sure was a pogrom, but it was a pogrom that swept across all of what we today know as unified or Greater Germany and Austria. And in every city, town, and village across Greater Germany and Austria, over 1,400 synagogues, yeshivas, and seminaries were systematically burnt to the ground. An additional 7,500 shops, but only Jewish shops, were looted and plundered. 30,000 prominent Jews were arrested, and 91 other Jews were murdered, all within 16, not weeks, not days, but 16 short hours, starting at 2 a.m. in the morning until 6 p.m. the following evening on that Thursday, November the 10th, 1938. And the real kicker of this came in was that all of Kristallnacht took place 10 months before World War II broke out, meaning a peacetime Europe. What do I mean by peacetime? In peacetime, you still have your consul generals and ambassadors in their embassies. You still have international businessmen, tradesmen, tourists, students from abroad. The initial question that shot through our minds for my wife and I was, how did life go on the day after Kristallnacht, on that Friday, November the 11th, 1938? How do people get up and go to work the next morning, walking out of their row houses and not noticing the burnt debris, the fluttering pieces of burnt out prayer books and Torah scrolls littering the street and gutters? How did people walk by the burnt out shells of the synagogues in those days? Remember, in Europe in those days, the synagogues were not like they are today, conveniently nestled into comfortable suburbia, but rather huddled down around the hub of the cities. How did people go shopping for the upcoming weekend on that Friday, November the 11th, 1938, and not notice all the Jewish shops, department stores looted and plundered or either boarded up already? Was it just business as usual? This triggered off a larger investigation for my wife and I, simply because now we had to go back and investigate some very incriminating and, yes, very personal questions that may have always lurked in the back of our minds, and now it was time to do some Pesach cleaning and bring them up front. The first matter of questions was as follows. Here we were, representatives of the Christian church, me having now tenureship in the church as a young pastor. I had to now go back and ask, following the weeks after Kristallnacht, before World War II broke out, in that 10-month hiatus, that 10-month interval between Kristallnacht and the outbreak of World War II, we had to go back and ask, where were our Protestant ministers and Catholic priests? Where were our theologians that would get up loftily in their pulpit week after week, as I myself was now following in their footsteps doing, preaching out a gospel of turning the other cheek? My wife and I went back and did a cursory review of church history over the past 1900 years. However, this time, when we reviewed church history, we did it from a different perspective than is normally taught at university. Why, at university, whenever you study church history and the sweep of Western civilization, it's always done from the dominant power position, namely, the Holy Roman Empire, which, if you investigate a little closer, you remember was neither Holy Roman nor an empire, but that's what they teach you in history these days. But this time, when we looked at the sweep of Western civilization, we looked at it from this perspective, from the point of view of Jewish communities that had to live under the yoke of the so-called Holy Roman Empire. And from that perspective, it gradually dawned on us just whose cheek the church had been turning for all those years. And it had not been their own. But we'd not always been members of the Christian leadership. We've been laymen, growing up to the rank and file like everyone else, So he went back and asked the second part of the same question. Following the weeks and months after Kristallnacht, when a voice of protest could have been and should have been heralded out to possibly wake up Christian consciousness, we had to go back and ask, where were the 186 million Protestant and Catholic laymen, those that would fill those pews and sing out those lofty hymns? Where were they that would have Bible study groups and prayer groups throughout the week, learning out the gospel, of going that second mile of the proverbial Good Samaritan? We went back and started asking some of the elders and deacons of our church, and some of the older ladies as well of the sisterhood. We asked them pointedly, what was it like to be a Christian on Kristallnacht? What was it like, we asked, to open your homes, to shelter the persecuted, to feed the hungry? What was it like, we said, to put the gospel into practice instead of just sitting around praying about it in theory? Often the elder deacons looked at us as if we just landed from Mars. The elderly sisterhoods, the older ladies, at best they would get teary-eyed, quiet, and look down at their feet, shaking their heads. At best, the only response we got out of them was often they would say, Reverend Wade, you don't understand. It was a difficult time. Until I heard that response one too many times by saying, I understand that it was a difficult time. But that's what we strengthen ourselves on in the gospel so as to rise to the occasion in crisis situations. What was it like, I wondered, to be a Christian on Kristallnacht? The more and more we asked and more we probed, the more and more we realized that we were gradually ostracizing ourselves from the Christian community. We noticed that more graphically by the distant click on the telephone whenever we would want to call some of our congregants. We noticed that also on Sunday afternoons when we would take walks through the city and see some of our Christian friends coming our way, only for them to spot us and cross the street not to have to pass us on the same sidewalk. After a couple of several instances like that, I remember one day joking with my wife by saying, so how does it now feel to be a new charter member of the local Hamburg leper colony? But the second batter of questions was equally as incriminating. But here I was, assistant professor to my supervisor at the University of Hamburg, looking forward to my first independent teaching position, hopefully in the fall at Cambridge. I had to now go back and ask, following the weeks and months after Kristallnacht, when a voice of protest could have been and should have been heralded out to possibly avert this oncoming Shoah, we now have to go back and ask, where were our college professors and university lecturers? Where were our professors of sociology then that would look back glibly onto Kristallnacht and talk about it as a classic example of man's inhumanity to man? Where were they then? My wife and I did a cursory review of Adolf Hitler Maximo's rise to power after he was duly elected by democratic means and appointed as Chancellor of Germany in January 1933, only to be shocked to realize that the first public organization to openly join the Nazi Party publicly were the university professors and staff members. First the medical faculty joined, then the law faculty, followed shortly behind by the misnomer humanities. But once again, I'd not always been a member of the university teaching staff. I was a junior member just starting out my career. So I had to go back and ask the second part of that same question as well. And that was, we had to go back and ask, where were our fun-loving, get-out-on-the-street-and-protest-for-any-cause university students? As the introduction said over, I did my undergraduate studies in the United States. Those are the late 60s and early 70s, the so-called turbulent years of American campus life. Those are the years of the anti-war Vietnam protests marches. Those are the years of the Kent State shootings, the rioting in the streets of Chicago, and the protest songs of Woodstock. We went onto the streets of Edinburgh, Berlin, and Hamburg, and the students in Europe were equally as politically sensitive. My, oh my, it didn't take much for the students in Europe to get out on the street and protest for any good social cause, whether it was the decimation of the Amazon rainforest or too many whales being killed in the Sea of Japan. They were out there en masse. I remember one day in Hamburg, I witnessed a major student university protest march. 6,000 to 8,000 students, placards, banners, blocking traffic, come marching through the streets. I stood on the sidewalk for a few moments and watched it parade by until I saw a student friend of mine, and I called him over. I asked him, I said, tell me, pray tell, what are we protesting this week? Can't remember exactly what it was. I'm sure it must have been something earth-shatteringly, maybe like boycotting Mexican lettuce or something like that. And I asked him one simple question. I said, why is it that wherever I travel around the world, studying in America and in Britain, now in Europe, and traveling also through Italy and France, Wherever I go, university students are always out on the street protesting. But I said, I got one simple question for them. Why is it that the university student protest marches, why is it that they always have to take place during class time? Like, why can't you do this on the weekends or maybe during winter break when you got more time to plan this out? Jabbed me in the ribs and said, shut up and keep marching. You think we want the public to take it seriously? No. This proved to me without a shadow of a doubt that my university students were that super sensitive social barometer of any injustice of the establishment. And I had to go back and ask, where are my university students after Kristallnacht, especially if the sociology professors are talking about it as a classic example of man's inhumanity to man? Well, I can only assure you that when I bumped into the answer to this question, I almost died a thousand deaths of embarrassment. William Scherer, the author of The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, intimates very strongly in his introduction that if you ever want an easy PhD degree, do your research in Holocaust studies. Why? Simply because, two reasons. One, the Nazis were very, very enamored with bureaucracy, paperwork, and documentation. They put everything in documentation, researched everything in the 12,000-year empire of theirs. Everything with rubber stamps and signatures, and in triplicates, nay, even quadruplicates. Everything was researched and documented. The second reason, he says, was that the Nazis were very fanatical in their wartime effort, and so much so that they never even entertained the idea that they could possibly lose this war. And so therefore, on May 8, 1945, Victory in Europe Day, when the Americans, the British, and the French met the Russians in Berlin to turn out the lights on Adolf's little party, believe it or not, the cost accountants, bureaucrats, and secretaries came to work that day. The Allies said, what are you doing here? They said, well, we're loyal. We came to work. So the party's over. Game's out. You can go home. Take the week off. Just don't come back to work. Meaning the Allies confiscated all of that documentation and paperwork. And now in hindsight, I see that the Nazis did us a great favor by putting everything in quadruplicates. Why? So that the Americans, the British, the French, and the Russians all got their equal share. It's all there. And you don't even have to be fluent in German anymore. I found the answer as well. Where were my university students after Kristallnacht? Statistics tell us that 5 out of every 8 university students all across Germany and Austria sided with their professors and openly joined the Nazi party. But the students didn't want to just voice their solidarity, they wanted to show their solidarity. And so therefore, they got out in the streets and borrowed every flatbed, lorry, and pickup truck that they could lay their hands on, driving around to all the school, municipal, and university libraries, plucking off the shelves all the Jewish books that they could lay their hands on, hauling them to the market squares to have large bonfires in the evenings to fulfill that which the propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels, had prophesied, a day will come when we will eventually eradicate this Jewish presence from our Aryan culture. I thought to myself, together with my wife, had a world gone crazy? Had a world completely lost it? How was it possible, here in the cradle of Western civilization, for something like this to take place? It was at that stage that we stumbled into that third more macrocosmic question, when we ask, yes, how could something like this take place in the most academic, refined, cultured nation on the planet Earth? I hate to pick on the sociology professors, but they provide me with a tremendous amount of incriminating evidence. They tell us that when modern man and the Western industrialized nations of France, England, Canada, America get their daily newspapers, they tell us that people in the upper educated ritzy sections of society don't read with any great interest the stories on the front pages, simply because they realize that most editors-in-chiefs of most newspapers have to sensationalize some of these stories on the front page to sort of get them sold out on the street corner. And so therefore they tell us that the people in the Western civilized upper sections of society move past the front page and read with a lot more intensity other sections of the newspapers, primarily the financial pages and for sure the sports pages. Apparently the rating of your local basketball team is a lot more important than hundreds of lives being slaughtered in Southeast Asia, but that's what the sociology professors tell us. But they also tell us that modern man has to know something going on internationally, and so therefore they tell us that the front page is usually the last page that's read. And they also tell us that people in the upper educated ritzy sections of society place these stories into psychological categories by which they're not too traumatized when they get to the office. They tell us that they put these stories on the front pages of tragedies and genocides into categories of third, fourth, fifth world countries. I always hasten to warn Jewish audiences that God forbid that we should ever use that nomenclature. Why? How close is it to the way Adolf Hitler, Max Schirmer, used to talk about subcultures? But nevertheless, they continue on by telling us that when modern man gets back to their offices, that often when they're with their buddies at the in their offices and industries, that often when they talk about these stories on the front page, they sometimes get a little bit racist and bigoted. They often say, I should get upset about these stories? I mean, they're not too far from the trees and being plucked out of the caves. I think to myself, possibly a little Elena, that we as Jews should speak like this, or even think this way. Why? Simply because it states in our own Holy Torah, in the book of Job, that we were formed in the same womb as they, and our blood is not any redder than theirs, and when injustice takes place anywhere, it takes place everywhere, and we have to be sensitive to it. However, this is the way the sociology professors tell us, that modern man in the upper educated sections of society deals with these issues on the front page. But I always wonder, and you'll have to forgive my wife and I, but some 25 years ago, we conjured up the following rhetorical, very acidly rhetorical question that goes like this. We always contended that something on the magnitude of this Holocaust, 6 million men, women, and children being decimated in a government-sponsored genocide, had something like this taking place in a country like Bangladesh or Upper Mongolia or between the Hutus and the Tutsis in Zaire, Rwanda. We always contended that people in the Western world could sleep better at night. Why? Because people, as I said, would often say, what, I should get upset about this? It's taking place in a 5th, 6th, or maybe 18th world country. But like I said, not too far from the tree. God forbid that we should ever think this way. However, the only problem was, is that we had to go back and ask, if this is the way modern man really does things like this, putting things in categories, yes, of racist or bigotry, categories of 3rd, 4th, 5th, or 18th world countries, then we had to go back and ask, how did modern man in the educated upper sections of society read the stories about Kristallnacht? Here they couldn't conveniently put them into categories of 3rd, 4th, and 5th world countries. Why? Because they weren't taking place there. Kristallnacht and later on the concentration camps, these were not even taking place in the second world countries. They were taking place in the first world countries. The Vaterland, Deutschland and Österreich, the home countries of Goethe, Strauss, Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, Schiller and Lessing, the home countries of modern medicine, opera, theater, the finest universities, medical research. America, Britain and France didn't even hold a second candle to Germany and Austria in those days. It was at that stage the proverbial scales started falling from our eyes and we started realizing what was going on and we focused a little bit differently in Western civilization. Were we to end this lecture at this stage and draw up on a little tally sheet and add up the score, you would definitely draw a very negative, very dour impression of this Rabbi Usher and his wife as to why we converted to Judaism. You'd probably think to yourself, well, I mean, let's face it, listen to that introduction. Maybe he's one of these bleeding heart liberals, one of these super academics. You know, maybe he just wanted to suffer along with the suffragists, so therefore he converted to Judaism. Or maybe you could draw a more clinical response by saying maybe he and his wife at that time were suffering from an acute case of masochism and wanted to see what anti-Semitism was like in the front row. Like, what's it like to get beaten up on the way home from high school every day? No. Couldn't be anything further from the truth. Rather, two more positive, two more upbeat questions that now focused our attention and eventually led us into Torah Judaism. Those two questions were simply stated, but at the time they were much more difficult for us to deal with. The first question was as follows. We wanted to know, who is this strange tribe of people on the planet Earth, these Jews? Who is this strange ethnic group that the World Encyclopedia or Almanac talks about as the smallest ethnic group on the planet Earth, and yet is so vocal and so visual that somehow or another, after giving them two or three generations in any country, they're now floated up to the leadership, whether of academics, whether of politics, whether of business, whether of entertainment, whether of medical research. They seem to always float to the top, and yet they seem to be the smallest and are rated as the smallest ethnic group on the planet Earth. Who is this ethnic group, these Jews that we wanted, for the past 2,000 years, have not had their own country, have not had their own army, and nevertheless have stayed intact no matter where they go, and they've been in exile for 2,000 years? Who is this strange tribe of people, we wondered? And somehow or another, we noticed in high school and in college that whenever they got together, they always somehow or another, you know the old adage, two Jews, three opinions, that type of thing, that we wanted to get behind some of it. I remember when I checked into the dormitory my third year in college, the kid next to me, I knew he was from my hometown, he was Jewish, but he bumped into another guy all the way down at the other end of the hall, who was also Jewish, that grew up 650 miles away from him. They never met before. But after they met, everybody in the entire dorm knew that both of them were Jewish. Why? Because in less than 30 seconds, they were arguing. But they weren't arguing like they were ready to fight. Oh, no, when we tried to break them up, all of a sudden they were arm in arm. They said, sorry, this is a family thing, you know. We wanted to get into this. How does this work? You know, they never knew one another, and all of a sudden, they're bickering like brothers and sisters, you know. We wanted to get behind this concept, you know, of two Jews, three opinions, and that type of thing. But we found out that we were not the only ones in history to have asked such questions. The aging King Louis XIV, King of France, asked his young up-and-coming philosopher Voltaire, give me proof, Voltaire, that God exists. Voltaire answered wryly, look at the Jews, meaning they shouldn't be here. Xerxes, King of Persia, had a standing army of 2.5 million soldiers. Where is he today? Some dust particles and some sand traps in the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, and not much more than that. Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, Charlemagne, Napoleon knocked his world around like a ping pong ball. Where are they today? There are some his pages in a history book and a couple of tourist traps in Europe, but not much more than that. Where are the Jews? They're like the little kids on Main Street watching the parade of history go by. Oh, that's nice. What's next? You know, there they are. Defying every theory and every law of history. It should have been swept away into the dust pail of history a long time ago. Historians even say that the Jews, with Abraham and Sarah, started out at the same time as the early Chinese dynasties. Look at where China is today. 1.3 billion Chinese. Look at where the Jews are today. 14 million of them, and half of them can't even be bothered to come here for a visit, you know? Just think, if Israel, if we Jews had never been exiled from Israel, we might be 1.3 billion. Well, let's don't dream ahead, okay? But nevertheless, somehow or another, for 2,000 years, haven't had a country or an army, and we've survived. So we wanted to know who these Jews are. Well, we weren't really sure how to go about attacking this sort of like question. And so we tried this door, that angle. And I stumbled into it in an area that had always interested me ever since high school. And I took it quite seriously even in college. Not doing it, but also researching and studying it. And then took it on as a private sort of interest of mine. And that was the whole factor, or the whole, I guess you could say, area of humor in human nature. And how humor plays a role. They even teach that also in psychology classes in regards to how humor plays a role in business, you know, how to do business courses as far as humor, breaking the ice with your new customer or making jokes with your boss, especially since you've been late to work for the past 2 months, you know. And you know how humor works in education, getting a point across to your students. And also in clinical psychology, I noticed that they use humor quite a lot, especially in the area of marriage counseling. I guess you got to have a sense of humor for that one. But one of the areas of humor that I noticed was also, though most people aren't public about it because it's maybe not politically correct, but everybody has their own little, in privacy, has their own little repertoire of ethnic jokes. You wouldn't say them in public, but you get your buddies together, you can let some of the juiciest ones in the world try. I mean, after all, I used to live in America. I know that the blacks tell jokes about the whites, and the whites tell jokes about the Puerto Ricans, and the Puerto Ricans tell jokes about the Koreans. When I lived in Britain, I lived in Scotland for 3 years. Oh, the Scots, they love to tell jokes about the old snobby English. And the English like to tell jokes about the backwoods Scots. Of course, the Scots and the English have to tell jokes about the Irish. Why? Because the Irish can't tell jokes at all. But, you know, so what I lived in Germany for 9 years. The Germans also like to tell ethnic jokes. They love to tell jokes about the Poles and about the Russians. But their favorite of all is, the Germans love to tell jokes about the Italians. Why? Because the Italians were supposed to have been Germany's great World War II ally. Well, so Germany knew that Italy was a very, very weak military power, but it swore total allegiance in that Axis arrangement. And so, therefore, Germany gave Italy just a small little job to do during World War II. That was, all Italy had to do was shore up and protect the southern flank of Europe. So Italy prided itself immensely on doing this little job, and it prided itself on its so-called invincible Italian army tank. You know the Italian army tank in World War II? The one that has 7 gears, 6 in reverse, and only 1 in forward. But as you well know, every ethnic group that likes to tell jokes about other ethnic groups, you know, everybody likes to tell jokes about the Jews. You know that old song, the Protestants hate the Catholics, and the Catholics hate the Protestants, and Hindus hate the Muslims, and everybody hates the Jews. You know, that type of But the thing that really gets me is that everybody tells ethnic jokes. And I noticed that of all the ethnic jokes around the world and ethnic groups, that the Jews are the only one that I've noticed that can also tell Jewish ethnic jokes. I mean, I've never heard a Puerto Rican tell a Puerto Rican joke. I mean, I've certainly never heard a Pole tell a Polish joke, but that's because they can't remember them. The Jews will tell Jewish jokes. I always wondered, why was that? I was born a WASP, you know. I wouldn't tell a WASPy joke growing up, you know. I see this is halftime entertainment. One of these days, I've actually threatened to bring my tape recorder in and play my lecture, you know, while everybody tapes it. I can get some sleep as well, yeah. So what happens is that I wanted to get behind, why could Jews tell Jewish jokes? Well, I was stymied by that. And it only came up, strangely enough, the answer to this question came up in a parallel study of mine, which was Holocaust studies. It happened to be I had the privilege of interviewing, meeting, and to a certain degree doing therapy with scores and scores of Holocaust camp survivors. And one of them, we happened to get off on the topic, and I mentioned about this aspect, that why is it that Jews can tell Jewish jokes? He said, oh, Rav Ashi, he said, you're interested in that? He said, I can certainly tell you why. He said, if you'll investigate a little bit closer into Jewish jokes, you'll notice that all Jewish jokes, they're all stories of Hashgacha Pratis, stories of divine providence. Why? Because the punchline, obviously, shouldn't have happened that way. You can always see the Yad Hashem, the hand of God behind it. I don't know whether he thought I was serious, but I did take him seriously, and I started investigating Jewish jokes like that. Strangely enough, he was right. I'll save you some research. Basically, I've noticed that Jewish jokes basically fall out into two general categories. One category is the Jew and his gullus, what he's had to put up with for the past 2,000 years of wandering. And the other category is the Jew and his Judaism, how he or she defines themselves vis-a-vis the Torah and the mitzvahs. One story to illustrate the first category, the Jew and his gullus, is pitted about 175 years ago in the small village in southeast Poland known as Lublin. There's an elderly Jew in his late 70s, and he comes hobbling across one of the streets with his cane, not making a lot of fast progression. All of a sudden comes whizzing around the corner a horse and wagon, much too fast for the street, doesn't see the old Yid in time, accidentally sideswipes him, but he turns around and says, ah, it's only a Jew, and he speeds on. The old Yid is spinning around, bleeding, falls, dying in the street. This whole incident takes place right in front of a Catholic monastery. A young priest in training looks at him and says, look, somebody's dying. Ah, he thinks, a golden opportunity to practice giving the last rites. So he lifts up his cassock, runs out into the street, kneels down next to the old Yid, scoops up his bleeding head, leans over and says, sir, do you believe in the Father? Do you believe in the Son? Do you believe in the Holy Ghost? And the old Yid leans up and says, oi, here I am dying, and the guy's asking me riddles. Jew and his gullus, what he's had to put up with for the past 2,000 years. Everybody's a comedian around him, yeah? The other category, the Jew and his Judaism, how he or she defines themselves vis-a-vis the Torah and the mitzvahs, also has a story attached to it. But I hate to have upstaged myself, but I was always told that whenever you want to tell a Jewish joke, you're always supposed to preface it by saying, by the way, this is a true story. Well, this one actually is. This took place about 8 years ago, back when I worked also, not only for Samap, but also worked in the Old City, the Heritage House for Rabbi Meir Schuster. It's a Jewish hostel, you know, that catches sort of, you know, university students hitchhiking around the world and wants to give them maybe a Shabbos or a taste of Judaism or whatever. And it was in January, and it was in wintertime, and I hate to sound cheesy, but it was a dark and stormy night. It actually was. It was back when it used to rain a lot more here in Yerushalayim, that's when Hashem should do more. And it was my night on to come into the lounge and do counseling. Well, it was thunder and lightning. It was sleet. It was like it was about 2 weeks ago if you were here. We had sleet, thunder, lightning, super high winds, like a hurricane blasting through here, hailstones, snow, rain, just about a mixture of everything. Well, I'm not the biggest tzaddik in the world, and so therefore I looked out the window and picked up my telephone and called down there. I wanted to beg off because of bad weather, figuring that I'd just get somebody on the other end of the line, like one of the junior residence managers, that would probably say, don't worry, nobody's here anyways, take the night off. No such luck. Who did I get on the other end of the line? The director, Rabbi Meir Schuster. When he heard that I wanted to beg off because of bad weather, he launched into me by saying, Ravosha, don't you know the Mishnah that says if you save the life of one Jew, you save a whole world? I said, I'll be in 10 minutes, Rabbi. I trudged in that night all the way to the old city. By the time I get there, I'm convinced that my hat is landed in Damascus somewhere. My umbrella looks like black spaghetti attached to an aluminum rod. My feet I had to take and wring out, you know, dump the water out of my boots, you know. As I finally get all straight and adjusted somewhat, and from being so disheveled, I walked by Rabbi Schuster at the main desk. He was on the telephone, the heater over to the side, nice and warm. Gives me thumbs up, go get him, Tiger. I said, thanks a lot, Rabbi. You know? I go into the lounge, and sure enough, as just as I suspected, there weren't too many people there. There was only one student sitting over by a table, you know, the same backpack, hiking boots, blue jeans, sweatshirt, ponytail, earring. It was a guy, of course. And there he sat with his map spread out across the whole table. So I pulled up the bench and sat down next to him, wanted to get to know him a little bit better. Found out, wouldn't you know it, yes, he's Jewish from California, just graduated Stanford University in molecular biology, and had won himself a position at Harvard Medical School for the upcoming fall. But because his father was also a physician, his father had convinced him, or at least tried to convince him, to take a year off, defer for 1 year, travel the world, see the sights, says his father. Why? Since his father is a physician, once you hit those medical labs, you're not going to see the light of day for the next 9 years. So the son told me how he'd listened to his father's advice, decided afterwards by mulling it over to take his father's advice, including his father's credit card, and he was going to travel and see the world. So this was January. He wanted to backtrack a little bit, catch me up on his travels, how back in August he flew across from New York over to London, how he'd done England and Scotland, how he crossed the Channel, how he'd done France and Germany, traveled further south, how he'd done Italy and Greece, I think 2 weeks earlier. He'd just come from Egypt, where I think Egypt had done him. And he was here recuperating, I guess what they call Pharaoh's Revenge, mapping out the second leg of his world tour. So I asked him, I said, tell me, where do you have planned to head off to next? He said, Rabbi, he said, I got to get away from Europe. It's too dusty and dirty, too hustle and bustle, too many people. I got to get away from it all, to the wild blue yonder. So I said, where do you have planned to head up to next? He said, next week, he said, I'm going to fly out to Kathmandu. I'm going to hike up at those Himalayan mountains. I'm going to find me a Zen Buddhist guru, then take off my shoes, climb a tree, and learn how to play the flute. I told him, I said, I didn't think that was such a brilliant idea, you know, especially under the category of wanting to get away from it all. He said, why not, Rabbi? I said, because more than likely, by the time you get up in those Himalayan mountains, you're probably going to bump into about 17,000 other Jewish university students wanting to get away from it all. It might get kind of crowded up there, you know. Needless to say, because of the bad weather, not only that, but I stayed late that night, and my friend didn't make it to Kathmandu. He bumped into Asher Wade that night. So I started by basically innocent questions and just finding out something about his background. Wanted to know how he was raised religiously. So I don't beat around the bush. I just asked him point blankly. I said, so tell me, were you raised Reform, conservative, conservadox, modern orthodox, sweet and sour? You know, what was your belief? He said, Rabbi, he said, I don't like labels. I said, what was him? I said, I don't like labels either. I said, so let's play 20 questions. We'll flush it out like a detective. He said, oh, that's much better. So we were asking this observance, that holiday, whatever here. Finally got around to keeping kosher. So I asked him, I said, so tell me, when you grew up in your home, did your mother keep a kosher kitchen? He said, oh, yeah, Rabbi. He said, we kept what's known as kosher style. I said, beg pardon? He said, kosher style. I said, what's that? He said, you don't know what kosher style is? He said, no, I guess I didn't hang around America to pick up all the fine nuances of keeping kosher. Right? He said, kosher style is very simple. Almost all Jews in America keep at least this. I said, what is it? He said, this is where your mother keeps a strictly kosher kitchen, but you know, you sort of like on the sly eat out in restaurants. I said, that's kosher style. He said, yep. I said, so wonderful. That means your dishes are going to heaven. He says, what? I said, your pots and pans have never seen any trafers in it, but this vessel called your stomach has seen the world cuisine pass through it. He said, what? I said, so don't be surprised on Resurrection Day when your kitchen goes flying up to heaven. I on my word, you know? Judaism was starting to get interesting now, yeah? But the main thing, the next question that really got our attention, the second of the two questions, was a simple question. I know you know the answer, but at our time, not only was this sort of difficult, but it was embarrassing that we didn't know the answer to this question. I mean, here I was, a doctor of the church, a theologian, a minister of a congregation, I had to ask the question, what is this thing called Judaism? I mean, let's face it, I didn't even know the religion of my own Lord and Master, J.C. And I don't mean J.C. Penney either. To find out that his religion was Judaism, I mean, this was a shocker. To realize, you know, to put on tefillin, tzitzit, you know, the whole business. This just didn't sit with my, you know, pristine or Christine position or focus on JC. It just didn't sit well. It was a shock to me to realize that his religion was Judaism. I mean, it doesn't happen very often, but occasionally it does. I certainly enjoy it, you know. One evening after I was davening Marv at the Coast Hill, I was walking back across the back plaza over to the place where you catch the one or two bus to come home. And there was this gentleman that sort of got my attention. Portly looking gentleman, sort of like a Sephardi Jew, had a kippah on, had a little golden necklace with a mug and David on it. And he said, got my attention, said, "Excuse me, sir." I said, "Do you speak English?" I said, "Yes, I do." Then he launched into it. He says, "Where is the hope of Israel?" I said, "Oh, no." I said, "Don't tell me you're one of these nutty fruitcake missionaries down here." He said, "What?" I said, "Do you really believe all that nonsense? You know that he changed water into wine? You know that he walked on the water?" I said, "How can he do that? He got holes in his feet. He'll sink. How do you do this?" And I started pounding on his chest because he was taller than one. You know, I got him right up against the wall. Good place to be up against the wall, you know. He said, wait. He says, "Wait a minute." He says, "I was trained that I'm supposed to ask the question." He said, "How do you know all of this stuff?" Well, I told him a little brief introduction about my background. You should have seen the blood drain from his face. He says, "Reverend Rabbi." He figured he had to get one salvo in on it. He said, "Reverend Rabbi, in spite of everything, what you've discovered, what you found," he said, "you still have to come back. You have to pattern your life after J.C. You have to be more like him." I said, "Excuse me." I said, "But as an Orthodox Jew, I'll be more like J.C. than you'll ever be." He said, "How's that?" I said, "Just like J.C. never prayed to a man, I don't either." This is a puzzle to us. To find out that J.C.'s religion was Judaism. What is this thing called Judaism? But the thing that made sense out of this whole two questions was a question that both my wife and I brought into the marriage, and that was a question that we had. We always wondered, what was the will of God for us Christians on planet Earth? Or better yet, even in a broader sense, what is the will of God for humanity, mankind on planet Earth, vis-a-vis, say, the biological sphere of this planet Earth? My wife trained as a nurse, and I obviously had biology in high school and college. We know that all the animals on the planet Earth, from the time they're born to the time they die, know exactly what they're supposed to do. We call it in science, they run on instinct. They don't teeter to the right or to the left. They know exactly what they're supposed to do. Humanity, mankind, has that so-called free will. We don't have a clue what we're supposed to do. You know, we don't know what we're supposed to eat, how to behave. You know, we don't know. You know, for instance, my roommate in college, as I was talking about, when he moved in, I was convinced he thought he was a bear during the winter. Why? Because he hibernated for 3 months. He never got out of bed. Either that or he thought he was a snake and was going to molt and get a new skin. Why? Because he never changed his socks either. human beings don't have a clue what we're supposed to do, what we're supposed to eat, how to behave, etc. But animals know exactly. Take a cow grazing in a field of grass and clover. Imagine one day the cow raises her head and says, "You know, this is crazy. This diet, grass and clover, sometimes it's clover and grass, but it's always a salad bar," says the cow. "Huh?" Says this cow, "You know, I think I'm going to go over to the pond and catch me a fish." The cow will never come up with that idea. And yet the cow can see other animals eating fish. So why not try it, you know? I'll tell my ever favorite of all, the farmhouse cat. Now being treed up this huge oak tree in the middle of the farm by the local farmhouse dog. The cat's up there not having anything else to do. Starts washing its paws and its face, you know? All of a sudden, a light bulb goes off in the cat's head, and the cat says, "You know, this is crazy. This is the third time this week this stupid dog has treed me up here, wasting my time like that, pretending like he's some type of paparazzi or something like that. And now that I'm thinking about it," says the cat, because I never thought before, "you know, he did this twice last week and four times the week before that. And now that I'm really thinking about this," says this cat, "his parents terrorized my parents in the previous generation. And the way this scenario is supposed to roll itself out, I'm supposed to have had a litter of kittens in the next generation. And in the next generation, his puppy dogs are supposed to tear around that barn and terrorize my kittens." Says this cat, "Today's going to be a different day." When this dog kind of gets a bit hoarse, pardon the pun, and wanders off, says, "I'm going to come off of this tree. I'm going to sally out to the local zoo," says this cat, "and I'm going to mate with a rhinoceros." Why? Simply because I want to make sure that my kittens in the next generation have half a chance against his puppy dogs next generation. Why? Because then that next generation, when his puppy dogs come tearing around that barn after my kittens, they're going to be in for a big surprise. A 6,000-pound furry creature with two horns on its nose saying, "Meow." The cats won't come onto this idea. Not unless they happen to hang around Princeton University biology lab. Come here, kitty, got a surprise for you this semester. Yeah, you know. Animals won't do these things. We humans don't have a clue. So based on that backdrop, we wanted to know, what is the will of God for us human beings on planet Earth? How does God want us to behave? Well, I went up to the university in Hamburg and asked some of my professors about this. They said, oh, Reverend Wade, do you like questions like that? We have a great philosopher that became a major church theologian. They call him a saint. He's a 4th century church father. His name is Augustine. They pointed me off in his direction and said, I'm sure you'll find the answer in this particular volume. Look around. So I lugged his volume home, started perusing through Augustine's writings. Sure enough, I couldn't believe it. I found his answer in 10 words or less. Believe it or not, Augustine says, answers the question, what is the will of your Father in heaven, says Augustine? Love God and do as you please. I thought to myself, isn't that a bit vague, Mr. Augustine? Yeah, love God and do as you please. I said, I know a lot of people who love a religious credo like that, especially some of my Jewish friends, approaching 2 days of nonstop davening on Erev Rosh Hashanah. Hey, God, I love you, but it's a great weekend. I'm going playing golf this weekend. Yeah. Love God and do as you please. I thought, that's a cheap shot. How can he get away with it? A pillar of the church. A great theologian. How can he say something like that? As I was stewing over Augustine's answer, my wife comes in, taps me on the shoulder in my study in my office at home in Hamburg. She said, you're still upset with Augustine? I said, sure. I said, how can he get away with something like this? Love God, do as you please. She said, well, rather than get yourself all upset about Augustine, why don't you move on and look somewhere else for the answer? I thought to myself, I'm the theologian in the family. Okay, I'll take 5 minutes out for this layman's question. Where, pray tell, would you look? I said. She said, well, it was up to me. She said, I'd look straight in the Bible for the answer. I thought to myself, there goes my male ego right out the window. And to come back with a good comeback, I said, listen, honey, I just wanted to exhaust all other possibilities for you. You have no more patience than that. We'll go straight to the Bible. I pulled it right off the shelf, started opening up, flipping around on the pages there. Turned over here to the right, on your Hebrew edition, a little bit too far to the left. All of a sudden, wouldn't you know it, my eyes fell upon it. And I said, there it is. Look, the answer is there. And radiant, black and white. The will of your Father in heaven, as it says there, do this, don't do that. Eat this, don't eat that. Behave like this, don't behave like that. Don't sit at the seat of scoffers, but sit at the feet of the sages and drink in their words. All of a sudden, I turned to my wife and said, wow, this is good. She said, uh-huh. I said, this is real good. She said, uh-huh. I said, this is too good. I said, you know, we're church people. And now in hindsight, boy, I wish I had good old yeshivish lushen, you know. I could have easily said, you know, I got a sermon right by Sunday morning. I got to have an upschlag for this by Sunday morning. I got to contradict this thing, you know. So this looks too good here. So I said, well, we got a real problem on our hands. So what do you do when you got a problem on your hands and need a quick answer? You do that which every mathematical student does when you need a quick answer to a problem. Look to the back of the book for the answer. So we turn to the other end of the Bible, the so-called New Testament, the Christian Bible. There we were flipping around in chapter and verses there, and all of a sudden, a few minutes later, our eyes spied upon it. Without coining a phrase, I said, look, there it is, we're saved. The will of your Father in heaven is, says J.C. Superstar. I made a movie about it. Yeah. Have faith, it says, he says. Have mercy, have love. Be thrifty, courteous, kind, clean, and reverend, like a good boy's conscience. I thought to myself, you know, these are great platitudes, these are great moral virtues, ethical principles, with airy, fairy things like lofty clouds in the sky. But compare these things on the back of the book. Who's that second mile? Pray for your enemy. Turn the other cheek. Compare that to the front of the Bible where it says, check your lettuce leaves for bugs. Well, that's pretty earthy, don't you think? You know? Go that second mile, and here it says, make sure that your cow chews its cud and has a split hoof. Do you chew your cud? Yeah. Wow, I thought to myself, how come we never saw this stark contrast before? Here in the back of the book, it's also, you know, philosophical, airy, fairy, lovely. And in the front of the Bible, it's so down-to-earth and practical, like on a minute basis, not even day-to-day, but minute by minute, you know, the day. All of a sudden, I looked at my wife and said, wow, this is amazing, you know. I said, how come we never saw this stark contrast like this before? She said, well, maybe we never cut loose to answer our own questions and just took the pat answers from the pulpit. I said, wow, this is amazing. But I said, you know, we can't make any snap decisions. I said, I've got to test this out. Slowly and surely, but, you know, I've got to test this thing out. So I decided I was going to run this one by my best friend and colleague at the university. He was 1 year older than me. He was an ordained Lutheran pastor, very pious. And he was also doing his doctorate by the same professor as myself. So often we would meet at have lunch together at university restaurants, and bounce ideas, academic thoughts off of one another. So I decided I'd spring this on him the next day at lunch. There we were at one of the university restaurants, and after our main course is finished, waiting for a cup of coffee and a piece of cake to be served, I turned to him and I said, you know, this past week, my wife and I have been dealing with that big question of Christianity. What is the will of God for us human beings on planet Earth?
He says, yes.
I said, you know, I went to our professors at our institute, and, you know, they pointed me off in the direction of Augustine.
He says, yes.
I said, you know, I took Augustine's volumes home, and I perused through what Augustine had to say, you know, but I just wasn't satisfied with Augustine.
He says, no.
And I said, I was stewing over Augustine, and I said, he really upset me greatly. And then all of a sudden, I got this brilliant idea. It sounded like a revelation. I said, why am I messing around with a church, a 4th century church commentator? I said, if I really wanted the answer, I said, I should look straight in the Bible for the answer.
He says, yes.
I said, I thought this idea was so brilliant, I called my wife in from the kitchen and said,
he says, yes.
And I said, guess what? We found the answer right there in the Bible. He said, of course you did. I said, would you stop talking like that? You sound like you wrote the book yourself. He said, well, Reverend Wade, what's so unusual about finding the answer to such a question in the Bible? I said, it happens to be where in the Bible we found the answer. He said, what do you mean, Reverend Wade? We believe in the whole Bible. I said, yeah? Look at this. I reached my briefcase, pulled out the Bible, opened it up, obviously, to the front section. I said, look at this. Do this, don't do that. Eat this, don't eat that. Behave like this, don't behave like that. He says, yes, Reverend Wade. But like all bestsellers, and it has been on the bestsellers list for the past 1,900 years, you know, like all good bestsellers, you know, has a great introduction. I said, this is no introduction. Don't give me that nonsense. That's Leviticus chapter 17. He says, yes, but, you know, like all good novels, the plot thickens near the end of the book. You know what I mean? I said, don't give me that nonsense. I said, I found an answer to a specific question. Now you're getting all upset. Where? I said, where's this whole Bible theology of yours? He said, wait just a minute. He said, have you forgotten what the Son of God has come to do? I said, what? He said, have you forgotten that the Son of God has come to set us free in the Spirit? I said, who? He said, have you forgotten that the Son of God has come to set us free in our manifest destiny? I said, who? He said, have you forgotten that the Son of God has come to set us free in our spiritual individuality, fulfill our potentiality on planet Earth, as spiritual creatures in the eyes of God? I said, who? He said, have you forgotten? He said, have you forgotten him as well? I said, no. But I said, I find it very strange that the whole week my wife and I have been dealing with, God the Father says, channel your energies here. God the Father said, restrict yourself over here. God the Father says, walk modestly over here. God the Father says, focus your talents and channel your energies over there. And all the time, you're telling me, the Son of God says you can eat that. The Son of God says you can do that. The Son of God said that's allowable. I said, what? Can't the Son of God even keep the 5th of the 10 commandments? Honor your father? Oops. He says, Reverend Wade, he said, I think you've gone too far. He says, I know you already for 8.5 years. He says, I know your line of logic. He said, you're cascading off into Judaism. I said, who said anything about Judaism? I said, like I told you, I was looking for a specific answer to a specific question. Now, you're getting all upset and jumping to conclusions. He said, no. You're not pulling a fast one on me like that. He said, I know you better than you think I do. He said, and I will admit, you are starting to make a little bit of sense. But he said, before you think you're coming up to me with this Judaism business, before you think I'm going to saddle up like some Sancho Panza and ride off with you as some type of theological Don Quixote trying to convert 2.2 billion Christians to Judaism. Before you think that, he said, I want you to go and ask the Jews one question. And based on that answer, I might come with you. I said, no problem. What's the question? Here I was, the great defender of Judaism. I was 1 week into it. He said, if this Judaism business that you've just discovered, if you think this thing is so logical and so clear-cut that you're willing to jeopardize your whole relationship with the church, jeopardize your whole career at university, upset all of your in-laws and your friends and family, just for this Judaism business. He says, then go and ask the Jews one question, and I might come with you. And that question is, why don't they, the Jews, keep this Torah first? I said, no problem. I'll be back next Thursday with the answer. That was 23 years ago. That question acted like a pebble in my shoe. And you know what happens when you get a pebble in your shoe? And you're out on a hike with your buddies. No matter how much down deep inside you've nursed the idea over the past decade or two that you really are Golani material, and nobody's recognized that yet, you know. But somehow or another, when you get a pebble in your shoe, it just does not find that empty space between your big toe and the next toe. It finds the most painful, sensitive place, and you walk along, ouch, you know, finally, ouch, you know, finally, hey, yeah, I got a pebble, but you got to deal with it. Yeah? That question was just like that. Well, I'd always wanted to go to the local synagogue in Hamburg. It was a little bit intimidating, but now I had a purpose. This guy had given me fire in the furnace, as they say. And this was a Tuesday, and I had to prepare myself for the next 4 or 5 days. I knew that this coming Saturday morning that I was just going to go to that local synagogue in Hamburg. And I just knew that I would slip in the back door. And I just knew that I'd see the entire Jewish community there on that Saturday morning, swaying in song and prayer with their prayer books and their talis and their prayer shawls. With the mezuzahs on the door, with the talis filling over to the side. With the mezuzahs, you know, on the door. With the esrogim and luvlavim swinging in the air, eating, munching a matzah meal, and sitting under a sukkah. I just knew I'd see the whole again. The only problem was that when I slipped into the back of the synagogue, that was where all the talking was. But it did get better as I moved up front. As I bumped into a young fella that first Shabbos when I was there, it was almost like two twin brothers separated at birth, lost, but now found. It was like two common souls. We hit it off almost like you wouldn't believe. After davening on that first Friday night, we stayed late and we talked for many hours, got to know one another. I found out that his family had made Aliyah from Montreal back when he was 12. He finished up university at the Technion in electrical engineering, and he was now a flight engineer for LL, and he was furloughed over every 6 weeks in Hamburg on R&R. And this was one of his Shabbos. Well, I waited in anticipation for the next 6 weeks, and then we hit it off again and started talking. And over the next couple of months, we got to know one another, etc. He showed up unexpectedly outside of his six-week schedule on the holiday of Shemini Atzeres or Simchas Torah. And everybody in the shul was happy to see him, you know, and I certainly was. And after Marv, you know, on Simchas Torah, they opened the Aron HaKodesh, and they bring out the Sifrei Torahs, and they dance around the bima. And since he was more knowledgeable and a lot more religious than most people in Hamburg, he was telling them, showing them nuances that we do in Israel here. And so he led the first three couples. He was sort of out of breath, so he adjourned over to the punch bowl for the fourth stand, where I was standing, obviously. And he was going to catch his wind and breath and go back and join him for the fifth. But I don't want to go into any great detail because it might be a shtickle of Akalash and Hara, but on the beginning of the fourth Hakafah, while he was standing with me, a big row broke out in the community. Who's going to get what Sefer Torah? Who's going to get this covered? Who's going to lead it this way or that way? They were arguing and screaming and whatever like that. All of a sudden, as all this was going on, my friend leans over to me, points out at the crowd as they're going at it one another. He said, just look at it. Just look at it. Isn't that disgusting? I said, well, you know, it is as it is, you know. And then he hit me with a real zinger. He said, you know, if I wasn't born Jewish, I'm sure I'd be the biggest anti-Semite in the world. I said, ouch. I said, don't say that. I said, but wait a minute. I said, you do see that. So why aren't you the biggest anti-Semite in the world anyway? He said, well, I don't want to flatter you and your wife, but getting to know both of you and what's your background and what you're planning to do, that you're planning to convert to Judaism. And then I find out recently that you've never been to any other Jewish community except here in Hamburg. You've never been over to London, to Golders Green, to Stanford Hill. You've never been to New York. You've never been to Baltimore, Los Angeles, wherever, Toronto. You've never been to Eretz Yisrael to see proper living Judaism. He says, this is all you've ever seen, and you still want to convert to Judaism? He said, look, no man ever doubts your faith. He said, but how is it that you do this? I said, well, it must be that my wife and I came up with a formula many years ago by which we're able to put instances like this, you know, in a context where we'll be able to understand it a little bit better. And that is, we always said to ourselves, never, ever, ever judge Judaism by the Jews. Judge Judaism by the Torah. He said, psh, where'd you get that from? I said, well, I said, I think I formulated that out of a little clipping that my father sent me out of the Reader's Digest from a North American Red Indian prayer. It says, don't ever judge your fellow brave until you walk 2 miles in his moccasins. Know where that comes from, straight out of Pirkei Avos about judging Dan L'Chavsut, judging favorably. But without it being anticlimactic, this is how it led into what we found, and this is what we have adjusted our lives to. We were looking for this voice from Mount Sinai, that voice of the Torah. We were looking for the voice of instructions. That's what the literal translation of the word Torah means, instructions. Torah's Chaim, the instructions of life. And this had, for sure, clarity. We were looking as Christians, believe it or not, for a little bit more than just a couple of hours on a Sunday morning. We were looking for a relationship with God, you know, on a Tuesday that was as powerful as Sunday morning as it should be on Tuesday morning or Thursday afternoon. We were looking for a relationship with God that was like 24/7.
Boy, did we find what we asked for. Wow.
You know, getting into, you know, the 613
million
commandments. But without being anticlimactic, as I said, this is what we were looking for, this is what we found. The only thing is that many of my students over the years have told me, they said, Rabbi Wade, you're not getting off that easily. It is one thing for you to say, quite glibly, you found the do's and don'ts of life in the Torah. But if you haven't noticed, Rabbi Wade, especially as a clinical psychologist, you should know better than that. Most people on planet Earth don't like to be told what to do. I said, you're right, most people don't like to be told what to do. As a matter of fact, most people like to call their own shots. You know, like, I'm going to be Rabbi Billy the Kid riding into Dodge City. I'm going to say what's kosher and not kosher here. Everybody likes to be their own rabbi, paskin their own halachas. Imagine growing up in your mother's home, and your mother had, over the years, had you socially conditioned, you know, like Pavlov's dog, ring a bell and you salivate, that she always baited you with your favorite, you know, dessert topping on Shabbos, that if you helped clean up the house on Friday, she'd give you double portions of your favorite dessert topping, which was what? Caramel cream sauce. Oh, you'd do anything for this. You'd climb marble walls like a cat for catnip, you know, for this stuff. And, of course, she would always dangle that in front of your face. And, of course, you would, you know, back in the house and set up the candles, whatever like that. Over the years, she had you totally in control, obviously. And about the age of 14, she comes home one day from the grocery stores, and she breaks the bad, sad news to you that, unfortunately, though she's checked with the local manager, unfortunately, the company that produces your caramel cream sauce has gone out of business. Oh, you think to get, this can't be. You tear Kriya, you sit in sackcloth and ashes, you know, institute a couple of fast days. This is terrible. After about 3 or 4 years of therapy, you finally get over this, you know. 20 years later, you're married, you got your own family, you're out shopping, helping your wife out. As you turn the carriage around to go down another shopping aisle in the grocery store with your shopping list, your eyes, peripheral vision, catches right on the shelf. You can't believe it. Right there on the shelf. 6 glorious bottles of caramel cream sauce. You pull one of them off, you look at it. This can't be. This is amazing. Same company. There's no dust on this. This is not old stock. This is new stuff. Trias, amazing. It's come back to life. This is amazing. You think to me. Forget this shopping list. You get the other 5 bottles off, you know, put them in the cash register, go upstairs, go up, check out. As you're driving home, you almost run off the side of the road. Oh, look how green it is. You know, it's going to be great, you know. You finally get home. You think to yourself, this is going to be a field day. You look at that bottle. It's wonderful. Mama brings back childhood memories. Where are you? You know, you're about ready to crack the seal on this bottle, you know, and you think to yourself, how did she serve this? Oh, she used to serve this over cake. Look in the cake box, there's no cake. How else? She used to pour this over ice cream. Look in the freezer, there's no ice cream. So you think to yourself, I guess I'll just have to mainline this stuff. Give me a tablespoon. You know? You're about ready to crack the seal of this thing. You take one last little gander at that bottle, and all of a sudden you look and say, oh, no, this thing doesn't have a hexer on it. So what do you do when it doesn't have a kosher seal on it? You put it back in the bag, make sure you have the receipt, and take it back to the grocery store, get credit on it for future purchases, right? Wrong. What do you do when it doesn't have a hexer on it? Let's take a look at the ingredients on this bottle here. All of a sudden, instantaneously, you become the Mashkiach Hador. The chief rabbinical supervisor of all kosher products in the world. Right? So let's take a look at the ingredients on this bottle. I'm sure this thing is kosher. Here, you know, it's the disodium phosphate. I'm sure that's kosher, whatever it is, you know. Propylene glycerin. I wish I paid more attention to high school chemistry class. I'm sure this thing is kosher. Looks kosher. Smells kosher. And God forbid, we're not going to upset the local rabbi on this one for, you know, his great studies. If all else fails, we'll have to do a taste testing examination to see whether this thing is kosher or not. And if all else fails, we'll take this thing to the mikveh and dunk it in and convert this thing. I know. Most people don't like to be told what to do. But I found a group of people that do love to be told what to do. And no, I'm not talking about the Marines in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. I'm talking about a group of people that not only love to be told what to do, but will even pay megabucks to be told what to do. And who is that? Much to my own embarrassment and chagrin, that's my old alma mater back in America, my university college students there. On one of my lecture tours to the States, I was asked to deliver lectures at 6 Ivy League universities in the Northeast United States. And after one of the lectures, I retired back to the Hillel House to wait for my ride to take me to the airport. I was told immediately that my ride would be late, so the students that were with me, about 14 or 15 of them, were quite happy because that meant they sat me down on the lounge and peppered me with all sorts of questions for the next 45 minutes. I was later told that it would be even further later, another hour or so. Oy vey, I thought to myself, well, the students said, this is great. So they called in other students and they were asking me questions. About an hour and 20 minutes later, you know, finally there was a lull in the action. I figured, well, this is my opportunity. I'm going to ask them some questions. After all, this juncture in my life, I hadn't been back to university campus life for about 2,500 years, so I wanted to catch up on current events. So I said, you know, there seems to be a very posh, upper-class, ritzy university here. This must be a good one. They said, oh, yeah, Rabbi, one of the best in the world. I said, it must cost a bomb to go here, yeah? They said, well, it's on the high side. I said, without being too tacky, I said, how much does it cost for one academic year here? So they put their heads together and buzzed for a few moments, and one of the students pro-offered and said, well, without all the frills and bells and whistles that go along with it, basic room, board, and tuition comes to about, oh, today about $36,000 a year. Wow. I said, must be a good university. He said, oh, yeah, one of the top five in the world. I said, based on that financial package, I told one of them, I said, let me ask you, what are you majoring in, besides getting out, of course? He said, dance. I said, beg pardon? He said, dance. I said, dance. I said, you mean to tell me that you're paying, or your parents are paying, $36,000 a year for you to, you know, dance? He said, yeah. I said, I don't want to step on anybody's toes, but I said, isn't that a lot of money just to learn how to dance? He said, well, no. I said, what year student are you? He said, well, I'm finishing up my first semester as a freshman. I said, wait just a minute. I did my math real quickly, fast forward. I said, you mean to tell me that in 3.5 years from tonight, you know, on graduation day, when you're all decked out in your cap and gown, you know, that long black robe with a waterboard with the scissors hanging off the side of me. I said, you mean to tell me that when you're filing across that, dancing across that stage, you're going to get up to that president. He's going to hand you a diploma and say, congratulations, you can go out and dance and you owe me $176,000. Turned to the other, I said, what are you majoring in? She said, drama. I said, drama. I said, don't know why. This is a classic example of a comic tragedy going on here. Drama for that kind of moolah. I said, wait a minute. I said, I'm sure I'm missing something here. Let me ask. What year student are you? She said, well, I'm finishing up my first semester as a junior. I said, you mean to tell me that as a junior, that you're paying, or your parents are paying, let me do math real quick. I said, you mean to tell me your parents are paying $247 a day for you? All of a sudden, she got a little bit red in the face, got quiet, looked down at her feet. I said, what's that, a classic example of stage fright? She said, Rabbi, she said, let me explain to you. She said, let me explain how a practical drama class works as a junior. I said, okay. She said, the way it works is that the, you know, semesters have midterms and the finals. I said, yeah. She said, well, the practical drama class here at this university, the first half, you have to write a parody on one of William Shakespeare's plays. And at the second half of the final exam, you have to stage this for the whole community. But the fair way that the professors figured out how everybody gets their characters is at the beginning of the, after the midterm, he puts everybody's name in a hat and you draw it out and that's who gets which character. Otherwise, it's unfair any other way. I said, that sounds okay. Which one did you get? She said, I had a heavy course load this semester and I looked at it. I got the easiest one of all. I said, mazel tov, what was that? She said, I got four roles away. I said, that doesn't sound easy. She said, no. These are four little walk-ons. I almost have no lines to learn at all. I just have masks and maybe costumes to change. I said, okay, so what did you do today in drama class that cost your parents $246 a day? She said, well, this is the way it works. Today we were going through Act 3, Scene 5, which is pretty heavy for the big guys, but for me it was a piece of cake because of this one particular scene or cue in the script. I have to play the role of a town crier. I have my mask and everything like that. And one cue, I have to come out four steps on stage right, turn 35 degrees, lift up my right hand and say, hear you, say the town crier. And I said, and? She said, well, that was basically it. I had to do it six times, mind you, Rabbi. I said, that's okay, I understand. I was in business. I know you have good days, you have bad days. I said, but let me ask you something. What would happen at the end of the semester? You know, when you're staging this, you know, you have the whole audience out there. You know, have your orchestra in the pit, you know, lights, camera, costumes, makeup. So what would happen if about 7 or 8 minutes before this little entree comes up that you just described, you got this wild idea in your mind that you're going to pizzazz this up, sort of like make a name for yourself under the category of Star is Born. I said, what would happen if you had 7 or 8 minutes and you had time enough to sneak all the way around backstage, and instead of coming up on stage right, when your cue comes up, you take 15 steps right out to the center of the stage, lift up both hands and say in a nice southern accent, hey, everybody, listen to what I got to say. Ah, it's the town crier. I said, what would happen? She reeled back. She said, Rabbi, you know what would happen. I said, what? She said, the stage curtains would drop. The lights would go on.
You'd be ripped off the stage, your understudy would replace you, and you'd fail the course.
I said, really?
She said, of course you didn't follow the script.
I said, really?
She said, you're not following the orders.
I said, really?
She said, you're not doing what the playwright wrote.
I said, really?
She said, you set me up, didn't you, Rabbi?
I said, really?
She said, okay, wise guy, what gifts? I said, I just had to hear you say those words. Because you don't realize it, but you basically paraphrased right out of the Medrash, where it says, blessed level in the days of Mashiach, that on that fateful day, this is based on the Pasuk and Bereishis in Genesis chapter 1, verse 3, where it says, Vayoma Elohim, Yehi Or Vayehi Or, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. But it says in the Medrash, and Rashi brings down part of it, that God took away that great supernal light, and he brought in the lesser lights of the sun, stars, and the moon. And on that fateful day, Lassad Lava at the days of Mashiach, he's going to turn on that great supernal light, and the divine playwright's going to lift up the stage, curtains off the stage of life, and what's he going to see? Holy boy, he's going to see all of his yidden out there, scooting around, ad-libbing, winging it, doing their own thing. Not following the script. Not doing what the playwright wrote. Just like you said. I said, I see that you like parodies on William Shakespeare's plays. I said, I'll give you one. Take this back to class with you. I said, I contend that William Shakespeare said a truism in one of his plays. Not an absolutely truism, but it's not bad to start off with. In one of his plays, he has that most famous quote. It's so famous that when I started, you'll probably be able to finish it for me. In one of his plays, William Shakespeare states, the whole world is a stage, and we are but the actors upon it. That's true, but had good old William added one more phrase to it, it would have been an absolutely true statement, and that is, the whole world is a stage, and we are but the actors upon it. It's just that some of his actors got the script. And that was us, Yidden, at Har Sinai. But what do we do when we get the script? Oh, we turn into the biggest buckies and mavens as far as script rewriting is concerned. Right. Now, that section over there, that's old-fashioned. We'll have to modernize that one up there. That one's over there, that's all written in metaphor, and I don't understand metaphor. That section over there, that's all steeped in Kabbalah, and I'm not holding it, that Madriga. It's no wonder that Jews invented chopped liver. By the time we finish with it, it looks like a bar of Swiss cheese. Well, like I said, without being anticlimactic, this is what my wife and I were looking for. This is what we found. We were looking for the whole ball of wax, the whole bar of cheese without the Swiss holes. But I'd like to end off tonight with one last little story. I started out tonight with a little aphorism about my last name, Wade, being a Jewish name today. I'd like to tell you about how I came under my first name, Asher. Because one of the advantages of being a convert is that you get to pick your own first name. You know, you don't get saddled with some old family heirloom. So I picked the name Asher, Aleph Shin Resh, which means happy, fortunate one. And it typified exactly what I was feeling in those days. I was feeling very happy and fortunate with what I found. Granted, now that I know a lot more Hebrew, I probably should have picked the name Asher, spelled Ayin Shin Resh, which means wealthy. But as you can tell from the way I dress, I hang around my Hasidic friends, but I'm not so convinced that they know how to pronounce my name correctly. I picked the name Asher, but oh no. I walk into their basement and say, hey, Rav Usher, come here. I said, Usher. My name's Asher. Hey, Rev Usher, come here. I got something to show you. I said, my name's Asher. Asher, Usher, backwards and forwards. One day I told him, I said, come on, guys. I said, give me a break. I said, I'm just a new guy on the block. You mean to tell me you had to wait 3,300 years for me to convert so I could teach you how to pronounce Hebrew correctly? You know? Asher, Usher, backwards and forwards. One day between job sites, I was riding the Egged buses here, and I was thinking about this vowel shift between Asher and Usher. All of a sudden, it went off in my head like a light bulb. I said, you know, Mamish, they're right. My name is Usher, not Asher. Usher, I thought. According to divine providence, they're telling me my job description. Why? What is an usher in English? U-S-H-E-R. Of course, I thought to myself. An usher, that's a guy in a long black coat standing outside the revolving doors of the theater of life with a script in his hand, telling all those latecomers and stragglers, come on in, the plot isn't thinking yet. Mashiach hasn't arrived just yet. I want to thank you for your time and attention for this.